They were hungry, and they were bored by extra portion of bread by night, things like that. And they gave it. This is at the number climb, particularly after the war was over. As it was not anymore a question of political or of committing present towards your home country, but only a question to maintain your own dignity. That about 90% went on the other side. Very sad story. In fact, his time as a prisoner was so bizarre because of the anti-war. And after I came back, I was terrified to hear in West Germany the same propaganda as I heard it in Moscow and in the camps from the Russians. And even worse now here in Canada, they're praying exactly the same sentences I have heard already in 1942 in Russia, not realizing that they're quotating something which is totally not true and wrong.
Were there any Antifa members in the camp that were important that you later heard of
in
Germany?
Oh, yes. Graf Einsiedel, of course, General von Seydlitz, who was a commanding officer of the 53 Corps in Stalingrad, and his chief of staff was Colonel Korver. He was our first leader of Block 6. So, these were... There were many well-known people. We tried to figure out what is it. It depend on education, it didn't depend on family, it didn't depend on area of the home. It was something across the whole German population, whether they were giving in or not. There were some non-commissioned officers, I know one in particularly, his name was Anders. He was the strongest character you could ever live. He finally threw himself under a truck to die because they mistreated him so terribly, but he was never giving in. And others, like the General von Seydlitz, afraid that he would not have all his baggage with him after his Stalingrad, gave in right away.
But for some, death was preferable to treason.
For some officers, yes. And I remember after the Russian officer in Lubyanka shot at me, I was really sad that he had killed me. Because I thought death is better than anything else here. And death, I think death is overemphasized here. Death is part of life. It happens to everyone, sooner or later. So we shouldn't overemphasize it.
Tell me about some of the daily conditions in the camp. Like, how did you keep yourself occupied? What kind of food did they give you? Things like that.
With occupied was not much, of course, we were talking. We were not really allowed to have cars, so we made ourselves private. But each time when the soprani or when the checkup came again, they were gone again. Many had to work. I had to work also often, but I was so badly off that even the Russians realized that I couldn't work. And in the morning you woke up and the only thought you had is what is coming, the morning soup. And then there came the soup, which is half a liter of water, good water, nothing in it anymore. As I said before, the Russians were taking the food we were supposed to get went somewhere else. And that was all. We got about, our doctors figured it out, we got about 420 calories per day. And that is simply not enough for them. Particularly not to do work. So people were forced to go to work and they promised to get an extra piece of bread. We got 300 grams of bread per day. But sometimes the bread was so wet that when you pressed it, the water was running out. See, that makes it more heavy, you can sheet with it. Then we got kasha, one spoon of kasha. Kasha, what is it? It's a...
like a weak porridge?
Yeah, something like a weak porridge. Some of the grains which grow there, hilzen. I don't know what this is in English. But it was never enough, of course. And this is a way that bored people. I remember a captain, Mark Graf was his name. He had the Knight's Cross. He was a fine tank man. Had become a prisoner within Stalingrad. He couldn't stand the hunger by night. I heard he was only a few places next to me. People came, he got something, he was eating something. So, and he always promised, no, never, I will go on the other side, but he did. And he was such a good man for the Russians that he worked his way up as a prisoner to highest ranks. And after the war, became the president of the police in East Berlin. But one day, in a bar, obviously I drank too much, he said a few things which were not on the line, and he disappeared. It was end of story, we have never heard. But this is the way the Russian did. We have met Ulbricht, who was later on the boss of the so-called DDR, the German Democratic Republic, or peace. He was a real instrument of the Kremlin. And all these communists, these old communists in Germany. So here the people have in Canada not even now realized that communism, the biggest lie invented ever, it can't work. And our unions, particularly the union leaders here, many of them are those who touch us throughout of England. And now they're here and making our life miserable. They're communists. They don't even understand that what they're saying is total nonsense. It doesn't work that way. Somebody who has seen the Soviet Union and lived there, who knows it, but people here believe, oh yes, the unions are doing us good. They're not doing good. They only want power, nothing else.
Do you remember any funny stories? Was there any humor between you and the men that you lived with?
Oh, yes. Once we worked, that was in Zelenodolsk, we worked in a plywood factory. And we in the camp, we had a Russian as a commanding officer, a Russian. He was, I think he was a professor of music in Moscow. He was a very fine man. And he had the idea, as better as I treat my prisoners, as better work they will do. Absolutely right. So we had to go to relations. He once visited us in the factory where we worked. You see, the factory is guarded like a jail as well. And there he saw an old building out of the pre-tsaristic time, or the pre-tsaristic time, with two wooden door, with a door to, consisting of two wings, huge oak, very beautiful made. And he measured it. And in the evening, he let us know that these were exactly the door he wanted to have in his house, which we were building for him. We had specialists for everything in the camp, so we were building him a house. If you smuggle these out of the factory, you get all of you 1 or 2 days free and double ration to eat. Okay. So one day during the work, some soldiers go there and dismantle these two things, bring them close to the exit and put coats over it that it is not seen what it is. Then suddenly the time is over and the Russian guards shout, antreten, okay, together, yeah, form in line. And there's still some missing, they're not coming. The guards are shouting, where are you? Come on. And then all those who were there started complaining, we can't stand anymore. And suddenly one of them collapsed You see, here, now we have a collapsed. We need a stretcher. So immediately, 8 men run to these 2 oak doors, laying one on the top, where the coats were over, and they lifted it, heavy as it was, put that poor man on it, and suddenly all the missing people were also there, and we marched out of the door. Outside of the of the control of the street was waiting our camp commander. He was only shaking his head. He said, "Young format, let's get off Sarah." So he kept his promise, and that was one of the funny stories. Oh, we have other stories. We had a magician with us. You know, they could do cigarettes, all these tricks, and he always duped these Russian guards with the looking dumb. Oh, we had many funny things. When, after the war, we met, we were always laughing, the survivors of us. And can you remember how that was kind of thing? We were laughing. We had survived. And I'm sometimes surprised this morning in the news, there were the passengers of that cruise ship which was attacked by the Somali border coastline, by it was shot at, and some of these passengers, so awful, I was sure I would die. And I would have laughed. They survived. What are they talking about? The captain did the right thing. Nothing happened, finally. Now, still a week later, doing as if you would trust being dying. See, this is attitude. That's a different attitude. And we went through so much hardship. And always I said to myself, there can even be worse. So, don't give in.
What one thing, other than family, obviously you missed your family the most, but what's the one thing that you really craved and wanted that you didn't have during that time in the camps? What was the one particular thing that...
Food.
Yeah. Any food or was
food.
It...
Food.
No,
anything.
Anything.
Hunger.
Hunger. Yeah.
The hunger dominated your thinking in every respect. By night, by day, you were so weak, you couldn't do much. You were laying around, couldn't do much. Hunger, hunger, hunger. And cold. Cold, cold. The freezing cold. Still today, I can't see snow. I hate snow.
What kind of temperatures were there in the camps?
Okay, in the winter, up to minus 35. As in many of the provinces of Canada, there's very cold climate. In the summer, very hot. In the winter, very, very cold. After all, we were above 51 degrees north, so the winter is strong. And you get this cold wind from the east, which goes through everything, through powerful, strong winds.
What was your clothing like?
Nothing. In the first winter, I had a little coat I had traded in or a rubber belt in the train, it's a 2 minutes. But it was for a kid. And half of the winter didn't have anything. So you either survived or you died, but okay. And it was very tough. Cold and hunger was the dominant torture, the permanent torture.
What do you attribute your survival to? What would you say was the one thing that kept you going throughout?
Difficult to say. I think a guardian angel, the angel had a hand over me. And my determination that I want to see it through. But basically I think, of course, everyone has a weak moment then, but to overcome it. You see, bravery and courage are two different things. Somebody who just storms a fortress is very brave. But the fortitude to do something, to overcome your own fear, is something else. I had learned that as a pilot. Because if people who were in the war tell me they never were afraid, they're liars. were done. I was deadly afraid. But that is what you have to do. You have to overcome the fears and do what you're supposed to do. And that was the same as a prisoner. I was so afraid when you were again and again pulled out, suddenly somebody came, you had to come to the interrogation. Your heart was sinking, you see. Your stomach was down. And it was each time the same, the fear. So you had to collect yourself. The fear. Hunger, cold, fear.
When did you find out that the war was over?
What they told us. On the 5th or the 8th of May, we all called together. There came our guard, Colonel Lieutenant. So the war in Kwanche, that means war is over. And the German prisoners jubilated. We were happy that the word of the murder was stopping. But we were absolutely sad in our core that all that effort had been for nothing. And the effort we made was incredible, incredible sacrifices. And still the world maintains lies of which the war had been started. If England wouldn't have declared war, nothing would have happened. But they wanted to destroy Germany, and that goes back into politics I don't want to go into, because it started 1880 around, when the American president finally had lost his real power to those in America who have the money to have the same up to today. And probably, I don't want to go into these things. There's much more to it. And I think the Western world still lives on the life. Because never Canada or England was in any danger. As we say now to Bush, you may not get danger by Iraq, why did you start a war? The same in 1939.
1945 was the end of the war, but you weren't released for another 4 years. Did you think you were going to be released? Did you expect to be in the camps for another 4 years?
Hope. As a human being, you never give up hope. Once you give up hope, you're dead. So we had the hope. But there were stretches of time when you doubted that your hope had any reason to be there. Three times I was on the list to go home, three times they put me back, and all these things. And then I came into a regime camp, and if it would have been for this Russian daughter, Kuchmigana, I would have then already stayed there forever. The last German prisoners were freed in 1955. One of my good friends, Captain von Petrovsky, he was shot down in August 1941, and he came back in late 1955. But he came back and he was unbroken. His spirit was unbroken. I told you the story.
How did you find Germany when you came back? How different was it?
Terrifying. I think the most successful thing the Allied had done for World War II is the re-education of German people after the war. Black was white, white was black. All values were reversed. And this re-education worked. The German people is so sure that they were the worst of the world and committed the biggest crimes in the world. The whole Holocaust happened. Give me a break. This is not so. But that was the most successful deed of the Allied. They did it in the same way which you saw in the jail in Baghdad. Very subtle sometimes, very direct, everything very cunningly, but they succeeded totally. And now everyone in Germany believes all this nonsense. I'll give you only a small example. there was Katyn. I remember that. The wood of Katyn in Poland, we found there about 15,000 Polish officers at Interactions Berlin. They were murdered by the KGB, by the Russians, by the NKVD. But now that the Germans have done it, after the war, in the Nuremberg trials, 17 German officers were condemned for deaths because of these atrocities where these 15,000 people had been killed. They were hanged. Later on, the Soviet Union admitted that they had done it. But meanwhile, a law exists in Germany. If you doubt anything of the results of the Nuremberg trials, you're committing a crime. Which means now, if you stand on a marketplace in Germany and say, the Russian committed Katyn, they have admitted it, you have committed a crime.